How you doing?
Fine.
Good, Steve. I'm glad you're fine.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Last week we talked about miracles and why we should believe in them. So this week I wanted to bring up often the objections that you get from when you're talking to people about the miraculous. And I'm sorry, Alan isn't here, because part of what I'm going to say is I'm going to talk to Alan. But last week we opened with a definition of miracles. And I don't feel like I wrapped that little section up very well. So what I want to do is talk about that again. And for anybody who's new to the class or doesn't come here a lot, please understand this is a class where we want people to talk and we want questions and we want interaction. So please don't just sit. Open your mouth, especially if you're not used to it.
But would you like it to be on topic and one question at a time, please?
On topic. Wow, that would be an amazing thing. That would be a miracle. That
would be a miracle, yeah. There's lots of working on it.
That's right. Okay, so has anybody been thinking about this last week? We talked about this. What did you come up with in your own mind as far as a definition for the miraculous? Can somebody say?
Oh.
No, Al, you weren't here yet last week. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I always thought that a violation of physical laws. In other words, if I got up here and I levitated, 10 feet or 12 feet without any support, which you've never seen, although I saw a guy on TV, I don't know if you've seen him, he actually levitated about 3 inches, and it was so funny because it was in New York, with the street guy, he did all kinds of tricks for people, and just leaves them amazed. Some of the women that were around, young girls, just broke up and they couldn't believe it. I couldn't either. I mean, looking at her from the TV, I said, but it's got to be a trick, right?
Okay, so let's stay with that though. Miracles are a violation of natural law. John?
I don't know if violation is the most appropriate word. I'd say there's one type of miracle which overrides physical law. God, being creator of all the laws, he could manipulate them as he wishes or override them as he wishes temporarily.
Okay.
Then there's the kind of miracle where he uses physical laws and that would not have happened otherwise, timing-wise. For example, he could cause a tornado, which is a natural phenomenon.
So kind of working behind the scenes.
One to accomplish a certain purpose within physical laws.
Now, who remembers what my objection was? Well, all right, go ahead.
The third is... I guess this is, one might say, ongoing miracles. The fact that we're living and breathing, the fact that there are physical laws in and of itself is sort of an ongoing miracle. That, again, uses physical laws, but they're always prevailing all the time.
Who remembers what my objection was to miracles being a disruption of physical law? Mark?
I dealt with point of reference and history. Originally, people thought miracles were related to spiritual things. They didn't even know there was physics.
Well,
so that was what you were.
I think that definition is a good definition of how we can understand it today. The problem with it is it's not the biblical definition. In biblical times, people didn't have that viewpoint. They had the viewpoint that there was no idea of natural law of cause and effect. Everything was caused. Everything that happened, the sun coming up, somebody riding by on a camel, somebody lighting a fire, the fire itself, everything was explainable by spirits that lived in the netherworld or wherever they lived, and they were doing these things. And God was another one of those spirits. God was the biggest spirit, and he was the one that could override those things. So the biblical definition really has to do with the idea of signs and wonders. God is doing this for a purpose, for a reason. And my sort of definition that I wanted to go away with was the miracles are a violation of natural law as we understand it today, but really what they are is they're one of many ways that God can communicate with us. And he does something in a way that he doesn't normally do it. That's really I think, a good definition for it. And it has a purpose. He never does miracles willy-nilly. He doesn't do just, you know, card tricks to entertain himself or us. They're purposeful. They have a point. They direct us in a direction. I shared with you guys the physical miracle that happened to me when I was really young. And I think the purpose of that was it's been in my head this whole time. And a lot of the times when I feel really dry and I feel really away from the Lord, I go back on that and I say, I know for a fact that happened to me. Ted?
If you recall, Jesus was called upon to do miracles, and he's just as a parlor trick or whatever, and he said, to this evil and adulterous generation, no sign will be given except the sign of Jonah. And he went on to explain, you know, that the resurrection was coming.
Right.
So people will ask for a trick, not to really see that there's a God, but so that they can deny it or make fun of it, like blind Bartimaeus was healed, you know, Lazarus was raised from the dead, many, many things that Jesus did. And they didn't even acknowledge the miracle, or they did, and they would seek to destroy the evidence for the miracle rather than admit that it happened or submit to what the miracle meant.
See, that's why I think it's ultimately relational. When Jesus was here and he knew that what he did, when he knew that the miracles he was going to do would have an effect on the people, he did them. When people were just looking for parlor tricks and be entertained, he said, no, that's not why I'm doing them. Okay. Alan Feynman, who's usually here in the back and has a lot of fun with us when we're back here, had a really good point, and I want to address that even though he's not here. I made this comment last week, sort of this. Everything in our common experience tells us that when we encounter highly complex, organized systems, like a car, for example, or information, think of a computer, they're the result of thoughtful design. Everything in our experience tells us that. Therefore, it's reasonable to infer that when we encounter the same in biology or other sciences, they too are the result of thoughtful design. This is a really, really powerful argument, I think. And it's an argument by analogy. And Alan said, just because, I mean, he's a great philosopher. You guys don't know this, okay? It's masquerading. But it was a really brilliant question. He said, just because it's a good analogy, does that make it true? And I gave him a smart aleck answer. And I said, well, when I say it, it does. But that was a smart aleck answer, and I want to address that because that's a great question. And really, the point is, it is a good analogy. I think it's an accurate analogy, but analogies are never 100% persuasive because they're not the same as the argument. If they were the same as the argument, they would be the argument. So there's always going to be some room in there for disagreeing with this. But remember what I said last week about us being assertive, aggressive about our faith and about our arguments. I find this to be a really powerful argument. And if you give this to someone, they have to answer it. Now, they may disregard it, but it means they will have at least thought it through, which is the point of this. So I wanted to know if you guys thought about this. What do you think of this argument? The other one I said was, in our common experience, we don't see things popping into existence out of nothing. Therefore, it's reasonable to infer that the universe did not pop into existence from nothing, because we don't see anything like that. Now,
but looking at miracles from the Bible.
Well, stay on this. Do you have a comment about this?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in biology, so take Jonah. Jonah was swallowed by a fish, right?
Uh-huh.
And then he spent, I think, 3 days in it?
Mm-hmm.
3 days in the stomach of a fish. Now, that guy that wrote that didn't know anything about a gastrointestinal juices or acids that could go right through I've seen it where it goes right through a piece of cloth.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have lasted, you know, a few hours before he was digested by that fish. So
you're rejecting the idea of it as being able to be a miracle right off the bat.
I don't think it's a miracle. I mean,
would you agree that it would have been a miracle had it really happened?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So what we're going to do here is try to make a case for, well, we did that last week, why we should believe in miracles, objections to miracles. Now, your objection is, doesn't make sense from a physical law standpoint. He would have been eaten up by the gastric juices in the stomach of the whale. That makes sense.
You mentioned something about your experience that you mentioned last week. Could you just briefly tell us some of the reports here last week?
Yes. Yeah, okay. I said this, too, because it's a little... It's not embarrassing at all, but it's very private. And this was the first time I've ever mentioned it in public, but I'll say it again.
Second time,
that's right. When I was young, my parents were both very involved with... My dad worked for World Vision. They were very involved with whoever came around. They would get invited into the house. Whatever adults were there, people from World Vision... people from off the street. It was the Jesus People movement. There was a lot of stuff going on, and I got very used to walking in the living room and meeting people that I never saw before that were adults and shaking their hand and saying, "Hi, how are you?" And I was actually a lot more comfortable with adults than I was with people my own age. And one time I walked into the living room and my dad introduced me to a man that was a friend of his who said, my dad said he was a healer. I think I told you last week that I was probably about 9. I think I was more like about 12.
I remember that.
Good, Steve. I'm glad you hold me accountable there. Good. It was just before my teenage years. I was still pretty small. I was short. I was shy. I had no confidence.
Nothing has changed.
That's right. That was a good one. All right, I'm storing them up, John. I'm storing them up. That was good. Anyway, so this guy said my dad said this guy was a healer, and the guy kind of took one look at me and he said, "Come over here." And he took a chair, asked my dad for a straight back chair, and he set it down, and he said, "Sit." So I sat like this. He said, "Put your backside tight against the chair, back of the chair," and he stood there and he took my feet and lifted them up, and for the first time in my life I could see that one of my legs was a little longer than the other. And he didn't make any big deal out of it. He just had them like, you know, he's cradling them like this, and he said, "In the name of Jesus, grow." And one of my legs in about 3 seconds grew maybe an inch. And the reason I know this happens, because I know there's a trick to this. I know there's people that do this as a show-off. I've heard about that, and it's not real. But the reason I know it was real for me was because my hip hurt. It was sore for weeks because of the realignment. I'm getting teary about talking about it. So that's my experience. And there's been a lot of times when I've really called on that experience when... You know, I haven't been feeling really close to the Lord. So it had a purpose. My worldview has to include the miraculous because that actually happened to me. And I know that it was real because my hip hurt. Now, somebody might say, well, maybe you wanted to believe in miracles and it was just a psychosomatic effect, and, you know, so your hip hurt because you really wanted ultimately subconsciously to believe it. Well, okay, if that's where you want to go with it. But that's not what happened. It really happened. I saw it. There were witnesses to it. It wasn't a trick. And that's when I started to grow physically. I got taller and taller. So, Al?
Did he do other things like that? People can attest to witnesses.
Apparently he had a reputation as being a healer when God led him to do it. I don't even know the man's name. I met him one time. I don't know anything else about him. Ted?
He was able to see that you had a problem by just meeting him after 3 seconds.
Well, or
that perception.
Or the Lord told him, this right. is somebody you need to do this with.
That, to me, gives the story a little more zip.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of power, though. A lot of power. You would think
you'd go. And now hundreds of people have heard your story, the people last week and this week.
Yeah.
So it's not just for your benefit. You know, Jesus healed people, but people have been reading about it for 2,000 years.
Right.
Every one of those healings affected the person and the people around them, but it's affected the whole human race. Every single word in that Bible. now you're affecting hundreds of people by you, and then it's on the tape.
That's right. So this thing happened, you know, like 40 years ago, and now it's affecting people. So yeah, that's the way it works. Yeah.
I like the feeling because I like about 4 inches. On both feet.
a little more on the other end too, Al. Yeah.
Beat me to that one.
You too. All right. All right. So here's what I'm. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Oh yes.
I was just gonna say, growing up, I had a story of my dad being healed from polio. He was 35, so he was an adult in an iron lung. And the atheist doctor told my mom, if you know anybody who will pray, you should pray because he couldn't pray. So she went to our really conservative Baptist church and said, or she called them and said, could you pray? And he had a moment of prayer meeting, which is not common for that to happen. And my dad lived.
Wow.
So I've heard a lot of discussions about miracles, and in our family it was miracles. But would that be? I mean, somebody could say, well, maybe his body was just.
Right. It's one of the things we talked about last week. Is so much of how you see the miraculous depends on your worldview. If your worldview is that there's no God, then you have to try to find an explanation for it that's natural and obeys physical law. If you believe in God, you may still not even believe in the miraculous because you may believe that God is distant or impersonal or is sort of a deistic God who just cranked it all up and took a long vacation. But if you believe in a God who's personal and interacts with us, that's one of the ways that he can communicate with us. It's one of the ways he can interact with us. So it's really a matter of how you see the world, how you're going to see the miraculous. Does that... I mean, to me, as... Oh, there are. Sure, and it's a very fuzzy, vague definition. I mean, that's what I'm trying to say, is that the definition is not as tight as we'd like to think. I wake up in the morning and I see those mountains and I say, the fact that I can appreciate the beauty of that is miraculous. It cannot, I don't think, be explained by evolution or natural law. There's something else going on there.
There's been several blind studies where they did have groups of people pray for people in a hospital, and then looked at the outcomes to see if the patients that were prayed for, got better, recovered quicker than the ones that were not prayed for. Christine, would that say like 2-3 times? Rich has got this information on his website still if you wanted to find it. And each one of those times they did it, I think it was two or three times they did it, the people that were prayed for, but even didn't know they were being prayed for, every time it was significantly, much more than 50%. I don't remember the exact numbers that the people are prayed for had benefits.
Wow.
Scientific evidence.
So, yeah, I think answered prayer falls in the miraculous category.
Amen.
This may be in line with what you're saying, Daniel, but there's a guy by the name of Francis McNutt, and he has been well known in a number of circles for praying for people for healing. And if you're familiar with medical phenomena, there's a certain level of effect that things can have. In other words, it's called the placebo effect.
Sure.
You can either take a medication, or in one of these blind studies, you're given some kind of a sugar pill, and if that combines with your expectation that you'll be well, a certain level of people will actually experience that. So for prayer to be meaningful, it has to exceed that placebo effect.
And I think what Dave is saying is that would make it because the people didn't know they were being prayed for.
Well, it's not so much whether they know they're being prayed for or not. It's the fact that you can exceed, if you exceed that placebo effect in these studies, what it's telling you when people are praying for somebody is that this is not an accidental phenomenon. This is not just based upon the person thinking that they're going to get well. It goes above that. And since it goes above that, it points toward the miraculous.
Yeah, I agree. Jamie?
It was a
Are these studies cited? Where we can look at them?
Rich,
you
got a question.
Do you have are those studies cited on your?
Yes.
Because I hear a lot of atheists arguing with saying that there is it's inconclusive.
Yeah,
I hear that all the time.
Rich, your website.
Website.
I would love to have it.
Rich, your website.
GodandScience.org.
GodandScience.org.
Yes, it's an excellent website.
It's interesting that most of what we've been talking about does do something for some people because they hear it. You know, and just like you were saying, the miracles have a purpose. And when I was 9, I was hit by a car. And I don't know if this qualifies as a miracle or not, but I did a flip in the air and landed on my leg and dislocated my knee. But the fact is I could have been killed. I could have landed on my head. You know,
mm-hmm.
I've always thought about that afterwards, that God had a purpose for my life.
See, that's a really good example, because you can see, even as a Christian, you could see that either way. You could say it was a random event and you happened to live, or you could say it was a definitely ordained by God event where you see it as it could have been worse. And but I would probably be able to say without you telling me that that's been a big event in your life, looking back on that. So in that, I would define that as miraculous then. Doesn't have to be breaking of some physical law. It was God's way of communicating with you something that he needed you to hear or understand or see.
Right.
And you've carried that with you. Yeah. Mark.
With respect to the slide that you have up there.
Yeah.
We can get into that.
Oh, absolutely.
No, you can't, Mark.
I know, I'm going to do it anyway. Everything in our common experience tells us that when we encounter highly complex organized systems, the result of thoughtful design. Therefore, it's reasonable to infer that we encounter the same as biology or other sciences, which I think is an interesting thing to put in there. They are also a result of thoughtful design. And I can see the analogy being very effective in some respects, in that if you have a car, I gave that as an example. We look at the car and we say, all right, there isn't really much, there's nothing intrinsic to a car that would make it manufacture itself or replicate. The problem is that in biological sciences, there is something intrinsic to the cell or to the plant or the seed that makes it replicate. So there's something behind merely the existence of the object. There's some kind of information that goes on that's intrinsic to the basis of the creation rather than just the object itself.
That's right.
So the analogy, I think, without talking about the information, the source of the natural organic objects like humans or animals or otherwise, the analogy won't work. But with that, it will, but you have to assume the information.
I agree. I think that the existence of information in the cell, in the first life form, is one of the most powerful arguments for a creator. Because if you think about it, think about my laptop. It's full of information. Where'd that information come from? Some of it I put in. Some of it was in the computer before. Well, where did that information come from? Well, another computer. But at some point, the first computer was created, and that first computer was infused with information by an intelligent source, a human being. The very first life form, we think it looked like a regular bacteria now, has enough information. It has about 1,500,000 bits of information in it, all having to be in a particular order, and the letters have to be just right. It's information just like this sentence is information. So the information in the cells in all of us, where did it come from? Well, it came from the cells of our parents. Well, where did it come from? It came from the cells of their parents. But you've got to go back to an original life form. Where did the information come from in that original life form when it's that complex? It's enough information. That's right. It's enough information. It's about the same amount of information that's in about a 250-page book. Okay, that's how much information is in a single-cell organism. So Mark's argument is really strong. Where did that information come from? Could this sentence have written itself? could some random process have put these letters together in that order? No, no one would even think that, because it communicates something that I wanted to say to you. So how can you possibly think that the information that's in the original, that's in the cell of the original life form, could have come about in any random process? The nature of information is that it has to be contemplated, it has to be thought through.
Well, there is the argument that there's an infinitude of universes, and therefore this created itself at least once, in fact, an infinite number of times.
Right.
And so, in other words, there are arguments that they turn out to be absurd.
Yeah, and that's the Easter Bunny belief. I mean, if you're going to believe that, there's as much evidence to believe in the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. John.
The flying toasters.
That's right.
In the Scopes Monkey Troll, the evolutionists argued at the time that if the cell, which they thought was simply a gelatinous piece of material, homogeneous gelatinous material with electricity going, they said if you could show the cell is machine-like, we evolutionists will lose our argument. Okay? So using their own words against them, it's more complex than any machine that we've ever developed. And henceforth, they lose their argument.
Yeah.
I remember Hugh's comment about a garbage truck inside of us.
Yeah.
I mean, each cell. Very much like the way garbage trucks are made. And a molecule, I guess. I'd love to find that article again because it's fascinating.
Well, the analogy I like to use, and then I'll get to you, Ted. The analogy I like to use is it's sort of the same as believing that a hurricane blows through the junkyard and creates a 747 when it's done.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really, and even that's not, maybe if it does it 100 times, then that's sort of on the order of what we're talking about.
But I think that what Mark's point is that I heard, which we may be missing, is that the genius of Darwin attempts to explain how that can happen in a biological system, starting with something very simple and progressing to what we see today as extremely complex, inexplicably complex. Now, so that means the task for us is to show how that starting organism at 2 billion years or whatever into the Earth's history, how that organism could have originated, the beginning of life problem.
Yeah.
Is that right, Mark?
That's right enough.
John?
So it may be reasonable to infer that the design we see in biology is the result of something. But the fact is that the majority of life scientists are still looking for the reason. They have a deep faith that they will be able to find the reason. And they aren't willing to accept the ones that have been positive.
Well, what you said is really important, because it is a deep faith. And there isn't a lot of evidence for trying to explain biology by natural processes. It is a faith. Val?
To me, the saddest thing is that there are actually television series that would have all these people swear that it's aliens that created us, publicly say that aliens were our ancestors, rather than give God credit.
Yeah.
I mean, that just shows you the extreme that they want to stay away from the God issue.
Who has the more reasonable argument?
Yeah.
Yeah, and what Hugh points out, it's one of the few sciences where there's less evidence every year, not more.
Yes.
All other disciplines, other than these origins, you know, every year you have more evidence, but for the origin of life, there is less evidence for that, you know, which is why Reasons to Believe came up with their model, which is there more evidence for Reasons to Believe's model, you know, in a supernatural creator for the origin of life, because there's more evidence for that, less evidence for the other.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. One of the ways you can tell where an explanation is going to be found for a particular thing is where is the evidence leading. And like you said, every year the evidence for a naturalistic explanation for origin of life, origin of the universe, origin of man is getting further and further and further away from a naturalistic explanation. Dan?
When Mark was saying that, John, we don't know, or the scientists did not know what is the purpose of this, there's something else in the animals they have programs, they have information that makes them, these programs, who put the information in there? And the Bible says to reproduce after their kind. That means the designer did it that way so a dog cannot produce a whale. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's after its kind. That's what the Bible says.
That's right. Al, and then I want to go on.
Yeah, I think there's something in the Bible that says that you shouldn't trust medicine or something like that.
No,
you should pray for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. Anyhow, the thing is, if any of us here, with our experience, should have say I have a child that's born with polio, what would I rather do? Give him a shot of salt. That's like a cure him in a week or so, or pray for him. Now there's a what is it science what is it people that don't
science of mind,
huh?
Science of mind, Christian science.
The Christian Science. They don't believe in any of that. They'll pray for that, but then there's laws that try to protect the kids from
right.
the parents. So I think all of us here would rather go with a shot of the salt vaccine. Then pray.
How about
I mean, but do one.
But science of mind.
Okay, just try praying, and you see that
science of mind.
I don't think there's anything opposed in those two views. I think you can do both. I think
you can do both.
You know, I think.
But before there was a salt vaccine, people used to die from that.
That's right. But there was also some healing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
But it doesn't cure polio. It prevents it.
That's right. Okay.
You have it.
What I'd like to... Oh, boy, we're going
to... have to refute that part, obviously. There's nowhere in the Bible that says you can't see doctors. Quite the contrary, Luke was a physician.
Luke was.
So one of the models.
Yeah,
the
he was.
So Luke was nowhere in the Bible where he was a doctor. So we don't make sure that states
I think
yeah. who had a... That's right. Okay. What I want to do is go to some common objections to miracles. And we've had a long time to talk about this now, a couple class and a half here. How do we respond to these? These are pretty common statements that the world would give us. We no longer need miracles as an explanation for anything. The corollary to that is science can explain everything. Well, how do we answer that?
You need infinite knowledge to be able to make, not infinite, but you have to have total knowledge to make a statement like that. And since no one has total knowledge, Einstein says, I don't know 0.1% of anything. So where does that leave the rest of us? But to make a statement like that is arrogance of the utmost degree.
Okay.
There's a lot of mysteries there.
Mm-hmm.
Lee?
I was going to say, that's just like a while back when they shut down the patent office because everything that could be invented. That's what they're saying here. I can just off the top of my head think of general miracles that happened. I know how that speaker box was made. I don't know how the intelligence was made in order to make that. To me, life is a miracle. To me, whether they're naturalistic or whatever, there's so many miracles that are happening. Every day you can look out here and see it. You can say, yeah, but you don't understand. Well, there's a lot of things like that. But to me, I've seen in the last 5 years several major miracles that have happened in my life. One of them, doctors say, when you're explaining to us, we don't see how it happened.
Right. Yes, sir.
I think one of the things that points to the fact that science cannot explain everything is all the research being done on the brain. And they're collecting terabytes and more petabytes of information about the brain, but they still don't understand how it works. Do you understand a tiny, tiny...
Well, if I was an atheist, I would say we don't understand it yet, but we will.
I think we will.
And?
Well, that's the science of the gap.
About the Higgs boson particle and...
The God particle.
Well, no, that was a whole separate subject. But what he said was, in essence, that what they discovered isn't what they expected to discover, and that it raised more questions mm-hmm. than they got answers, and that they're looking to 2015 for another. And I think that's what science does. Mm-hmm. It discovers, and then how come?
Yeah.
There are more questions, and as you said in the finding the source of life, they're running out of anything really to do, and we're now in discussion, whatever. But science doesn't explain everything. It raises. When I took science, there was no dark matter. There was no dark energy. That didn't exist. Now it's a big deal.
Yeah, that's right.
So science is a way of asking questions. It's not a way of explaining reality.
Jamie?
Kind of rolling it around my head, but it doesn't seem to me that miracles are an explanation. They are a proof. Jesus used them as a proof of who he was, as a good example. I don't think it was an explanation of anything.
Jamie's saying that miracles are not an explanation for anything, that they're more of a proof.
Yeah, what do they explain? Are they explaining something, or are they showing? I mean, when they happen in the Bible, for instance.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think that gets to my point that they're there for a purpose. They're there to communicate something. But no, they don't. I don't think they explain.
Like, I think what this statement is like, we're explaining the beginning of the universe by some miracle.
What's that, Mark?
I said, what about the origin of the cosmos? I mean, it is an explanation. It's a miraculous creation. So there are things for which we use miracles as an explanation. We use miracles of creation of life. We deny that life arose spontaneously. What is the explanation for? God did.
And that's how I describe what happened to me. I call it a miracle.
A shameless plug for Professor Fanny, the visiting scholar of Reason to Believe, is writing a book on the human brain. Even the scientific community is looking forward to it, because she has been one of those leading science biologists, bring forth all these different studies and everything and put it in common English to talk about the human brain. And it does wind up looking miraculous, because the human brain obviously has so many faculties and capabilities that were there 50,000 years ago that we weren't using. So why do we have all this hardware to do advanced math and lots of other things and have to carry that for 50,000 years before we use it? So there is a miraculous thing in the brain which is going to bring forth some of those things.
Yeah, that's a very powerful argument. It would be like saying, let's write a program for the computer, and while we write this program, this other program sort of shows up side by side that does something that we didn't expect it to do. It's a ridiculous argument, because both have to be specified. They both have to be written consciously. So for us to be able to do math 50,000 years ago, to have the capability of being able to do it, how can you explain that from an evolutionary standpoint? That's a very highly specified part of the brain that had to come along. It seems to me it had to be designed. How do you get that by it randomly by itself? It doesn't work. Okay. I have a list of some things that somebody says science can explain everything. I'd say, really? Do you love your wife? Yes. Explain that to me scientifically. Are you conscious? Yes. Some people don't think so, but yeah.
My wife.
Explain that from a scientific standpoint.
So, I don't know about other scientists, but in math, there are problems that have been proved that you can't figure it out one way or the other. That right there says to me that you can't understand anything. Like, we can prove that we can't understand anything.
We can prove our ignorance.
Yeah.
The thing is, neurologists can make you feel anything. They can make you feel love. Beliefs. They can make you, by putting a little tiny bits of current through your brain. So until we really find out about the brain, we're just kind of, treading water with all this stuff. Because as far as miracles go back to the time of Christ and before. They're very, very superstitious. They believe everything was a miracle. They believe in in virgin births. They believed in safety. They believed in all kinds of things, but you know, that were imaginary. But they believed them. They were you know, that was them. Now, you know, we're supposed to be more scientifically minded, and we know a lot because of what science has taught us. But we're still, you know.
We're one of the most scientifically literate countries in the world, yeah. And yet about 90% of the people in this country still believe in God, Al. But so I don't think it's not an irrational thought. It must still make sense. John?
They don't create love in the brain. They tap into previously existing information and memories in the brain which occurred before. So they're not creating anything. They're only calling up stuff that's already there. Okay. But the hard core reality of a pure atheistic point of view, we have to face up to this reality, is that you have absolutely no free will if atheism is true. Because you can't, there is no such thing as free will in a purely tinker toy universe. A pure molecule, pure materiality. There is no freedom of will. So your wife, who you thought loved you for all these years, she had no choice about the matter. Which I think that's a logic. No, never mind. The point is, you had no free will in coming here. Okay? You have no free will in anything you do. It's all a random collection of molecules interacting chemically. And that's the logical extent of atheism. Now, if you want to claim that you have no free will, you know intuitively that that is absolutely ridiculous. You know that intuitively deep down.
I claim that God resides in our brain and our neurons. And you're taught God. That from where you're born with a clean slate.
Well, you had no choice but to say that.
You're not born with spirituality. It's put into you by your parents.
See, it means nothing.
And then it comes in here, and then you got religion.
The problem.
Nothing.
I lost it about 20 seconds ago. All right. The problem with that, Al, is there's a section in the brain that only human beings have that gets triggered when we're doing spiritual things. It appears to be there for that purpose. So it wasn't put into us. People find spirituality even when they're not taught it. It's part of who we are. So the things that I see, science can't explain everything. I made a little list here. Love, the color green. How do you explain to somebody the color green, what you see, how you perceive it, your feelings about that? How do you explain that from a scientific viewpoint? Rationality in the first place. This is a really powerful argument, and I tried to make this last week. The idea that the universe is rational in the first place, so we can think these things through. Why should it be? What is there about a random collection of stuff exploding to cause the Big Bang that would leave us with a rational universe? Doesn't that imply that there was a creator? Can you see how people would believe that who believe in God? I don't think you can even explain the rationality, the very basis of us arguing about this without a creator. Beauty, how do you explain beauty? Evolution cannot explain beauty. There's a lot of our brain that's dedicated to that kind of thing that isn't necessary for our survival. If evolution is true, what really matters isn't rationality, it isn't beauty, it's survival. And the evolution would not have given our brain that much space for those things. Consciousness in the first place, and free will, I agree. Any atheist who tries to convince you of atheism isn't really an atheist. Because if he was an atheist, he would not believe in free will. If you don't believe in free will, you can't convince anybody of anything because there's no free will to choose the thought. It's a self-defeating argument. Okay. Let's try the next one. I think we beat that one.
Yeah, we pinched. Yeah.
Science can only... this is my favorite one. Science can only study events and entities that have a natural explanation. Really? I've heard this several times. What if some random thing that happens in the universe, and we studied it for 1,000 years... in using every scientific method that we could, and we never came up with a scientific explanation for that phenomenon. according to this, all of that work that we did to try to study it wouldn't really have been science because we can't explain it. Does that make sense? So this is patently untrue. John.
There's a maxim in science that's often called say the phenomenon. It means that all, you never deny the data, you always use the data, your observations are primary. And just because you can't explain a phenomenon doesn't mean that it should be discarded. And it seems to be that that is happening in a lot of cases these days, that the people that claim to be pursuing the scientific method are actually denying the data, just as they did at the Origin of Life conference that Dr. Ross mentioned, where all these papers said what they were proposing was utterly impossible and the odds were absurd. And at the end, Stephen Gould gets up and says, well, we can see it's all against us, so we know evolution is true, and it must have been some space aliens that directed a little ship
right
to this planet or something.
See, and that's where you can say, you, Mr. Atheist, have a basic faith just like I have a basic faith. I think my worldview fits the facts better than yours. But yours does. You're saying there is a natural explanation, I'm sure of it, but if I push you two or three times to say why, you're not going to have an answer. You're just going to say, because that's what I believe. Mark?
That statement is a linguistic trick that defines out of existence.
Yes. That's right.
It presumes a certain metaphysic to start with. And when you presume something to start with, then you define everything else out of existence. It's a stupid statement.
So it's a circular argument in one sentence.
In one sentence, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable.
Doesn't quantum mechanics contradict this statement?
Well, the quantum mechanic, the quantum mechanic person would say no, that we just don't understand it completely. But I have one. And I think I taught on this a couple of years ago. I think there is a line of study which, if you really think it through, Al, you will have to agree that there is a pursuit, a line of study, that if you study it scientifically, you come up with the unalterable conclusion that it is a supernatural explanation. And it is.
What?
It is.
Like what?
It is. Near-death experiences.
Now,
there's a very specific kind. Al, if you were standing in the back of that room, okay, and I asked you, and you're listening to me, and I asked you a minute from now, what did I say? And you repeat back to me at least some of what I said. Everyone would believe that you said it because you heard it, not because you dreamed it up. Okay. Let's say you went out of the. Let's say you went a mile away, and I'm talking to you, or I'm talking in front of the class, and you come back in, and I ask you, Al, what did I say? If you repeated exactly what I said,
that would be something.
That would be something. I'm glad you're admitting this. I'm going to bury you. Okay. Hang on.
Here it comes.
No one would imagine that you dreamed it up. Everyone would have said there was some way in which you heard it. There's a radio in here, the microphone, some way you heard it. Okay, now. Or I told you, or there was a trick to it. There are examples of people who have been on an operating table. They had a near-death experience. They claim to have left their body, and when they came back to consciousness, they were able to relate events and conversations, either in the room or even in another room, that actually happened. My favorite story is the one with this woman had a near-death experience. She left her body. She was conscious of what was going on the roof of the hospital. And there was a tennis shoe up there that somebody had thrown up there. She'd never been to the hospital before. She came back to consciousness. She relayed that experience to one hospital worker. They went up on the roof, and there was the tennis shoe exactly where she said and exactly how she described it.
And it was red, like she said.
And it was, she had the color and everything right. Now, she relayed something that related to reality, something that actually was. So she couldn't have dreamed it up. There's no way you can dream, you don't dream up reality. Strange enough as it is. So she saw the tennis shoe. She physically wasn't there to see it. She was on the operating table. How do you, somebody try to venture a scientific, rational, natural law explanation for that? You pretty much have to deny that it happened. But the problem is, there's coming to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these stories. You can't deny every one of them.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sorry. But, you know, they've studied those, and every doctor can tell you that different stories about, you know, near miraculous healings and stuff like that.
I'm not talking about a healing.
And that comes from the brain. I think when you
how does the brain see something, Al? Hang on. See, you're not doing it. How does the brain see something that corresponds to reality? How do you imagine that?
Well, I was just saying, when you starve the brain from oxygen, which you do when you're dying, you know, you're going to see all kinds of things.
But you're not going to see the truth. You're not going to see reality. You're going to see a dream.
I know what you're saying, and that's a mystery. I don't know. What are you going to say? Is God that did that?
Hey, that would be a good one.
Yeah, it's a gap, isn't it? That's a God of the gap. We don't know.
Oh my goodness!
You have such great faith.
I
had a VIP.
John. Hang on, everybody. Hang on.
This phenomenon occurred for a neurosurgeon. He had a very severe case of meningitis, and in a coma for several weeks. And they were his attending physicians were discussing removing the life support system and surviving and passed away. It turned out that he did recover just about that time, and he reported a very extensive experience, and he had written a book called Heaven is Real, and he was featured on the cover of Newsweek.
Yeah, this is pretty recent.
And with regard to explaining the phenomenon, for instance, with the woman who received something in the room from the hospital, I'd say one explanation is that is clear evidence for the existence of alternate perceptual modes for consciousness, and that phenomena observed in the body are only part of what a conscious person is or experience is, and that there are other modes of perception.
Sure, but
not based on the physical world, yet they're capable of perceiving correct information about the body.
But what you have to admit, if you're an atheist, is that the consciousness of that person was no longer in the body.
Yeah.
Because the consciousness, I don't know what else to call it, the consciousness, the soul, went out of the body and saw something that was real away from the body.
And the modes of perception are independent of the body.
That's right.
They don't necessarily operate.
So isn't that evidence, isn't that really strong evidence that there is a spiritual, non-physical side to us? And if you really think about it, the fact that she remembered it is also something. Because people who are strictly naturalists will say everything is, all memory is physical in the brain. Well, she had left her brain behind. She was in another place. She saw something. She remembered it. So part of our memory has to be in our spiritual self. Susan?
The start of that article in Newsweek says he's a neuroscientist, and he said all neuroscientists know that there's no consciousness once you go unconscious. And so when he came out of it, he said, this is something I am really going to have to study now, because I know that isn't true, that the conscious goes on once you're unconscious.
Very interesting, yeah. Ted?
There's an awful huge area of reality that is not physical, the world of mathematics, all symbolic representation, all language symbolism.
Information,
all non-physical reality that has to be dealt with. It exists in the real universe and in the field of all things known by humanity. Non-physical reality causes the physical reality.
That's right.
First of all, I had an out-of-body experience. I'd been drinking, right? And I led back to my and I swear that I floated out of my body, and I went up to the ceiling. I was looking down at my body. Now, I could say, well, maybe that was God, or I could say, is the reaction of my brain to the alcohol.
Could be.
It could be. So, you know, it's your brain, like I'm saying, it's, we still don't know a heck of a lot
did
of
you
it.
See your red
now,
tennis shoe?
But, yeah, but...
see a red tennis shoe on your roof. That's,
yeah, you'd have seen something 3 miles away. Red tennis shoe.
Yeah, I mean...
I didn't see a doctor.
If you,
I was the only one there.
If you had seen your back... and maybe there was a tear in your shirt or something stuck to your shirt, something you couldn't have seen looking forward, would that have convinced you that that experience was real, not just your brain firing weird?
I never thought, you know, I always, like I said, I was drunk.
Not good to do a study.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I was conducting a scientific experience on my brain.
All right. I've got about halfway through where I want to go, so but that's fine. We're having fun here. So let's try one more. We've got about 5 minutes. Science cannot explore the miraculous because science can only study that which is repeatable and regular. This is a common objection. What's the problem with this, John?
It could maybe only study the results of the cause, symptoms of the cause, but the cause itself could be supernatural.
It could.
Could be.
Okay, what else? There's a major flaw in this argument, and that's where you're going. To say it.
I said there's a lot of things in the universe that only happen once.
It basically rejects all historical science.
No. Yeah.
If you want to study anything in the past, it only happened once. The origin of life only happened once. The origin of the universe only happened once. Any event in the past, you know, somebody winning the lottery, it only happened once. According to this, it's not science. You got to get rid of paleontology and archaeology and forensics and all of that stuff because it only happened once. So it proves too much.
Well, the second half, science can only study that which is repeatable and regular. If it's not repeatable and regular, like you said, it's not studyable, but it doesn't say it's not science.
Yeah, I agree.
Right.
So science has its limitations. Even though they don't want to admit it.
That's right. So a scientist may not believe in miracles. A scientist may think that science excludes miracles, but it does not. That's a personal opinion on the basis of the scientist, Gary.
Philosophically, can't we presume that the description is not the described? Everything that's happening, we're... through our perception or our language, you know, we describe things, but what we're describing isn't what the thing is. The thing already is whatever it is before we put descriptions on it. And all science is a process of describing things. And if that statement there, that which is repeatable and regular, well, you just said this, repeatable and regular would only be the science of probability. In reality, repeatable is never repeatable. Everything that happens is its own thing that happens. How many times something similar happens, how regular and similar descriptions of what we see happen is not to say that it is described is that which...
It sounds like what you're saying is that we can describe things as best we can, but we can't know everything about them because there's always going to be descriptions about them, features of them that we can't see or can't understand.
Even what you call laws of physics.
Right, which we're always...
Laws of physics are descriptions of what we call observable phenomena, but our observable phenomena is even tainted by our capacity to perceive.
And our worldview, how we see things.
Our sensible and perceptual capacity.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of thinking that the other issue that kind of got me off of what you were talking about, that even though we say something's repeatable, we say, oh, when I do this, it has this outcome. The outcome is not always exactly the same. regardless.
That sounds like what Gary's saying, yeah.
So, like, if, you know, if I have this cause, if I have these five causes and I have these five effects, it's not necessarily all effects could be similar, but they're not all going to be exactly the same, which is, you know, standard deviation and whatnot. The personally, though, my main point, my main feelings against this statement is that really, if you have enough information about the effect of something, you do not need it to be repeatable. And I find that in my work, if a machine crashes, the computers collect log files of it. We can go back and we can look in the log files, which just give details of the effect, and pinpoint it all the way back to here's the cause. And that's kind of science, and it would only happen once. But because we're able to look at the effect, you can look at what. The cause.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more, and then I have to close, I think. Val?
This would make the Big Bang non-science.
That's exactly right, because that's a historical science.
And we have lots of data on that.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm about halfway through, so sometime I'll finish this. So thank you, everybody.